Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking with Gillon Darcy Wood. He's a writer. He teaches here at the University of Illinois. He's a professor of English at the University of Illinois. And he has, earlier this year, published his first novel. It is an historical novel. It's set in New York in the 1820s and particularly revolves around some of the events in the life of one individual, a man named David Hossack, who was a physician. A rather well-known one, someone who, among other things, was known for having founded Bellevue Hospital in New York and also with Columbia University Medical School at a time when yellow fever was a very serious and continuing problem in New York. And that is also a theme, an event, a challenge that runs through the book. That is the efforts to deal with this problem at that time. The book is titled Hossack's Folly, a novel of old New York. It is out now. And if you're interested in seeking it out, looking for it in the bookstore, you certainly should be able to find it. It's the Other Press that is the publisher. And he's been good enough to come and spend some time talking with us here this morning about his book and the story and the time. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you'd like to join the conversation, you are welcome to do that. Thanks very much for being here.
Oh, thank you very much, David, for inviting me.
I was interested in this book for a couple of reasons. I think one reason is that Gilded Age New York seems to be a period that has great appeal for writers, and there are a lot of novels that have been set then. Just this spring, I talked with a woman who wrote such a novel, and then not very long ago, I think it was just last week, I talked with somebody who wrote a nonfiction book, a book about Boss Tweed. So we're sort of talking about the same time. This time is a little bit earlier than that, earlier right. In the history of New York and in the history of the country. And one of the things I think maybe one of the reasons that those Gilded Age, those turn of the century novels appeal is that while it seems to be another time, in many ways you can recognize it as modern New York and modern America. And it seems like the time that we are in now in a lot of ways, particularly because of the influence of the robber barons and political corruption stuff.
Yes.
I think nowadays people look at those stories and say, "Well, things haven't changed very much." This is earlier. This is earlier in the history of the city. Are there still ways, though, that when you look at New York City, say in the 1820s, that it is recognizable as New York?
Yeah, certainly. And I think one of the reasons that I chose the 1820s as perhaps the most compelling decade between the British occupation of New York during the Revolution and the Gangs of New York, New York, the Civil
right.
War, New York,
yeah.
the draft riots, New York, is because New York is embryonic New York and begins to come into its own. It's in the 1820s that the population of New York overtakes Boston and Philadelphia for the first time and assumes its status as the most important sort of commercial and trading port. And also there's wholesale political realignment occurring across the country, but particularly obvious in New York with the Voting Rights Act, which enfranchises greater portions of the population, the rise of political populism through Jackson and the Jacksonian Democrats, and the rise of tabloid newspapers, the influence of journalism, which plays a big role in the novel. And even though my chief goal was to recreate the decade of the 1820s, I always had half a mind on the current political predicaments of the United States. And I wrote much of a good portion of the book during Clinton's impeachment. And so scandal mongering and the effect of tabloid journalism on politics plays a big part in the novel. And not to give too much away, but Hossack is brought down by scandal at a particular point in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And the influence of journalism on politics was a particularly important issue. The other aspect of 1820s New York that seemed to me to be particularly fascinating was that two problems converge to produce the potential for calamity in the 1820s, and that is the perennial threat of yellow fever being imported by ship up the eastern seaboard from the Caribbean, killing hundreds, perhaps thousands of people, potentially, every summer. And the more long-term problem of the viability of the water supply in Manhattan. Manhattan has had plentiful natural streams and wells, but by the 1820s they'd either dried or were putrefied. And so there was a compelling social need for the improvement of the water. And this crisis came to a head about the time in which the novel is set. Mm. And I suppose my fascination in the novel was with creating, with both recreating a history and also creating a plausible political scenario in which these two problems might be solved or not solved.
Yeah. As people will hear from your accent, you are from Australia.
Yes.
You grew up there, and then you came to the United States to go to graduate school at Columbia.
Yes, that's right.
In New York. And apparently it was there that you started to become interested in the history of New York City, this particular time, and also then came across this man, David Hossack, who was a very important figure in the history of Columbia.
Yes.
And yet even at that time was someone who apparently had largely been forgotten.
Yeah. I mean, I hunted around Columbia looking for some reference to David Hossack, and there is a small brass plate in Low Library. But it was really in the archives of Low Library, which is the university archives at Columbia, that that Hossack presented himself to me as such a compelling figure who demanded revival, demanded rehabilitation, or a rescue from oblivion. And I read his personal papers, but I also read issues of his medical journal, The Gazette, which was the first serious medical journal in the United States. And most of its pages were devoted to arguments back and forth over the yellow fever. In particular, Hossack's own diatribes against his enemies, his political enemies, and his enemies in the medical profession. And again, this is an important plot element of the story, who were arguing that the yellow fever was produced locally by unsanitary conditions, which is, of course, a convenient argument if you're wanting to maintain the unfettered flow of trade in and out of the port. Hossack, on the other hand, who understands correctly that the fever is imported from the Caribbean, wants to impose a quarantine on the port, which is, of course, crippling to the merchant community and as such. So going back to what I said before about keeping half an eye on the current political situation, it's a very much a global warming sort of story where Hossack represents progressive, enlightened science, and he comes up against kind of flat earth science in the same way that, you know, the Bush administration hauls out flat earth scientists to say that global warming is unproven. Hossack faces the same predicament in the 1820s, trying to get his point across that the threat to the city is posed through trade and through the port, and that no amount of pettifoggery and about unsanitary conditions and privies and what have you is going to solve the yellow fever problem.
Of course, that is a public health problem.
Oh,
and those people who said, you know, what the problem is that the city is growing so fast that the people are relying on inadequate and polluted water supplies. Uh-huh. So one of the themes is that some of the people in the book have proposed this enormous public works project to construct an aqueduct to bring adequate, fresh, clean water supplies into the city, which certainly was an issue. I mean, there are plenty of diseases that are spread that way. Yellow fever, not one of them.
Yeah.
But there certainly would have been good reason to get behind a project like that.
Oh, of course. And I think it must be because I'm a teacher of poetry that I enjoy paradox and contradiction so much, because that's what drew me to the story, was that there were two laudable political goals here: the protection of the securing of the city from an imported disease, yellow fever, but also the securing of the water supply in the long term by the building of the Croton Aqueduct, that these two laudable political goals are brought into conflict with each other in the novel. It's that for various complicated reasons of political allegiance and party politics, one can either support the quarantine or one... or the aqueduct and not both at the one time. And this is the paradox that the characters find themselves in and the moral dilemma that they face. Of course, both are needed, but how can both be produced in this new hard-driven commercial society that is also more and more democratic? And that is, you need to have a kind of have to have a political agenda that appeals to a broad base of people in the city and is easily communicable. And I suppose a larger question that I'm asking about the issue of health crises and public health and politics is that how well is the democratic system geared toward producing solutions to long-term issues of public health? In the 1820s, the water supply. Today, global warming, for instance.
Our guest is Gillan Darcy Wood. He grew up in Australia, came to the United States, to New York in 1992 on a Fulbright scholarship to study at Columbia University. He's published extensively on 19th century art and literature. And the book that we're talking about, Hossack's Folly, is his first novel. It is set in New York in the 1820s and does contain a number of real-life characters, among them the man that we've talked about, David Hossack, who was a real person, who was the founder of Columbia University Med School and also Bellevue Hospital, that was set up as a place that you could take people who had yellow fever. It was so that they could be both treated and quarantined as a way of trying to contain the disease. And that, that was Hossack's Folly. That's what people called it. Bellevue did.
Yeah, well, Hossack's Folly names a number of different things in the novel, and certainly one principal thing it names is Bellevue Hospital, which becomes a favorite object of the partisan press. That it is a white elephant built 2 miles beyond the city limits. Only half its beds are filled at any given time during the ordinary course of events. But of course, you know, Hossack, who is my, for all his faults, is my social visionary in the novel. He's the one who realizes that just such a facility is needed in the event of an epidemic. And again, not to give too much away, but Bellevue Hospital does come in for some use at a certain point in the novel. And his folly is also, just to tantalize listeners a little, is also his predilection for sexual liaisons with women of the lower orders. And
I like the way you put that.
And I mean, I'm waiting for an indignant email or letter from one of his descendants reminding me that he was, in fact, the historical David Hossack was, in fact, a good family man, untainted by scandal. But I already have an answer prepared, and that is that in exchange for rescuing Hossack's great civic achievements from history, they have to give me a little bit of sex in return. I hope they're happy with that, with that exchange.
Let's talk with someone who is listening. Ian Urbana, line number one, right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It sounds fascinating, and I love historical novels.
Because
I love to find out about earlier times. My question is, it seems to me this would have been a fascinating biography or a fascinating look at the time that there were all these factors stirring in New York, and I wonder why you chose the format of a novel.
Oh, that's an excellent question, and one that is a little difficult for me to answer. Well, first of all, I mean, as David brought up the obvious, particularly obvious on radio, fact of my accent, I'm an Australian, and didn't feel particularly qualified as an American historian might be, trained in history to write a biography. And also, another reason along those lines is that I also have another life, a double life as a scholar, and all my scholarly work requires pages and pages of footnotes, and I saw writing a novel as an opportunity to dispense with all footnotes and sometimes to give me the poetic license to stray from strict historical accuracy at times. And the other thing is that America, since I was a teenager, or even before, my mother taught American history in Australia, so I've always been fascinated with it. And so I suppose for me, America has always been, even though I immigrated here 12 years ago, it's always been the locus of my imagination as much as my reality. And while I would never dream of writing a, a novel about England, which is the subject of my scholarship, and I write mostly historical scholarship. To me, America is the locus of my sort of fictional, fictive imagination. And it just seemed a very, to answer your question in short, it just seemed a very natural thing to write fiction about America, historical fiction, rather than history proper.
May I ask what your scholarly life revolves around?
It revolves around the same period, around about the 1820s, a little earlier. But my scholarship focuses on London. In particular, I'm in the English department, so I teach mostly poetry and fiction, Keats and Wordsworth and Austen. But my scholarship deals with the relationship between the arts, between painting and sculpture and literature and music and opera and literature. It's I suppose my two big interests are the big cities of the 19th century, or two of the big cities, New York and London, and the culture and politics of New York and London. And I do my history in London, and I do my fiction in New York.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much for calling.
Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps we talk a little bit more about David Hossack. We've mentioned, he was someone who was important as a medical educator. He was important for working in the field of public health and in particular battled against yellow fever at this time. Interestingly enough, another feature of his life earlier than the book takes place is he was the physician who was present when Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr fought their famous duel, and Hamilton was fatally wounded, and he took care of Hamilton, although there really wasn't anything to be done,
exactly.
Apparently. He literally just sort of sat there and watched Hamilton die, because
exactly.
That's pretty much all anybody could have done.
Yeah.
Tell us some more about him, those things that we really know about.
Yeah. It's interesting that he's been lost to this to historical memory to this extent, given that he was present at and helped to engineer so many key institutions in New York, and that he was present at this fabled moment, what the historians have called the most dramatic moment in early American political history, the duel, or some call it the assassination of Alexander Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And the novel opens with my fictional recreation of the duel. It's been much in the news lately because last year, 2004, was the 200th year anniversary of the duel. And it was reenacted in Weehawken, where the duel took place. But, of course, they couldn't find the exact place because it's now the entry to the Lincoln Tunnel. And so it doesn't really exist as a dueling ground as such. And I wrote that the very first part of the novel, which is the recreation of the duel, very late in the piece, wanting to ground Hossack's the formative incident of his early life, and really not just for the voyeuristic thrill of recreating the Burr-Hamilton duel, but to really show how Hossack, at least in my own fictional recreation, Hossack's personality is formed by the duel. It's a moment in which he felt helpless and in which he blames himself for not having saved Hamilton, essentially. And that this, in the novel, forms his personality. And it's what gives him the great motivating desire to somehow compensate for this moment, this terrible moment when he was a young man, when he failed to save Alexander Hamilton, that great icon of New York. And so the rest of his life is busily trying to make up for that and founding all these very important civic-minded institutions and setting himself up as an indispensable civic figure in the city. And so he comes across as a figure of great energy, but also blinkered by his own sort of psychological scarring from the duel.
Yeah. The conflict in the novel essentially is created when you have on one side you have Hossack, who is interested in trying to do something about the continuing yellow fever and is very concerned that there would be a major outbreak, as there was in 1814, yes, apparently, in the city. And he, even though no one at this time really knows what causes yellow fever, and there are a lot of competing ideas, he does have this idea that it's that people coming on ships mm-hmm. are coming, and they're bringing it into the port, and that's the way it's getting there. Mm-hmm. So he says, well, what we really need to do is need to impose a quarantine, or else we're going to have a serious epidemic. So the conflict is between him and sort of that interest and the economic, the business and political interests that in the novel are represented by the mayor, a newspaper publisher who wants to run for governor, mm-hmm. and one of the city's wealthiest, if not wealthiest, men,
yes.
who all find their interests, you know, the one guy wants to run for governor, so he needs to get the backing of the business community.
Yeah.
He also has his plan to build the aqueduct and has to get the backing of the business community. Uh-huh. But the business community wants the newspaper to oppose the quarantine.
That's right.
Because if there's a quarantine, that's bad for business. So
yep.
there's this very tangled between these three men and their interests, political and business, this very tangled web of you do this for me, I'll do this for you, and everybody's yeah. got to do something for somebody else that they perhaps might otherwise not be inclined to do, but because they've got their own interests, particularly the man Eamon Casey, who's the newspaper man who wants yeah. to run for governor,
yeah.
you know, he's if the power, if the elites in the city don't back him, well,
that's right.
he doesn't have any hope. And they say to him, okay, this man says, okay, we'll back you in your bid for governor, but there's a little something we want you to do for us. And it's
exactly.
this very, very tangled sort of
yeah, rubber. Tangled. Tell me about it. It's very complicated. And my advice is to young writers that's setting out to write political historical novels is maybe put it off for a while. I hope the having put it through the dozens of drafts that I have, that it's become a sort of a thrilling web to unravel. And the novel actually began as a rather more simple thing, as a kind of comedy of manners. I'm a great fan of Jane Austen, and it was, and there's still a, for all the politics, there's a romantic subplot that is kind of an homage to Jane Austen. But it was also much more of a comedy when it first started. And but a lot of the jokes only I found funny, and I was convinced by my friends and my agent to rewrite it. So I dropped a lot of the slapstick, kept a good amount of the social satire, and became much more intrigued with the politics. And so the crafting of the plot became the most challenging aspect of the book. And realize, I mean, when you come to write a novel, the thing you realize is that people have to have a reason for just walking across a room. I mean, you have to provide a motivation for absolutely everything that everybody does. And when the stakes are so high, as they are in the novel, I mean, the viability of the city, people's careers, people's livelihoods, people's reputations, these are on the line. Everybody has to have a motive for what they're doing. And it very quickly becomes the kind of scenario that you describe, where people pay each other off, make complex sort of quid pro quo arrangements with each other. And most interestingly for me, and I think most interesting and most rich for any novelist, is the placing of characters who are neither inherently good nor bad, but potentially both good or bad, depending on circumstances, in situations where they have to make extremely difficult choices, mm-hmm. where there are no good choices. And you mentioned Eamon Casey, who is, during the various drafts of the novel, became much more interesting, was originally kind of blackguard villain, tabloid newspaper editor of a particularly sort of familiar stripe. He becomes a much richer character when he has political ambitions for the best of reasons. He wants to see the aqueduct built, and as you describe, he needs to make all these sorts of shady political deals in order to realize that very noble ambition. And so in many ways, even though the cast is a rather sort of Dickensian ensemble, a lot of there's no real principal character, there's a whole range of different people who are important, he is the one who travels perhaps the most classic 19th century arc from toward a kind of new self-knowledge or a new sort of new recreation of himself. And he begins by committing a whole political black acts early in the novel, but by the end of the novel is I think more redeemed in the reader's eyes, And sort of remakes himself sort of in the mold of Hossack. So from being earlier in the novel, he's pitted against Hossack. Hossack's the aura of Hossack comes to mean something to him. And by the end, they're fast friends. They're drinking and disputing over bottles of sherry at Hossack's villa up on the Hudson by the end of the novel. And he's really remade himself from being a muckraking pressman into being a kind of a new generation of civic visionary along the lines of David Hossack. So I think for a novelist, that's, to go back to the question that was asked me before by the listener about why a novel and why not a history? It's because a novelist can investigate the psychological interiority and the motivations of characters to a much greater depth, to show them passing through all these different possibilities for themselves and making the kind of moral judgments that will determine their character, their reputation, their status. And I think it's that kind of work that... That's the art of the novel, and that's what draws us to the great 19th century novels. And to the extent that my novel succeeds, I think it's what will draw people to my novel.
Yeah. Our guest is Gillan Wood. He is Assistant Professor of English at University of Illinois and is the author of Hossack's Folly, a novel of old New York, his first novel. It's published by The Other Press. And if you'd like to read it, seek it out in the bookstore. Questions, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I didn't actually go to the trouble of checking, but I guess I'm assuming, but maybe I shouldn't assume, I should ask, that the characters we were just talking about, Eamon Casey, the newspaper man, the mayor of New York, and this businessman, John Laidlaw, were they all, in fact, real people? Or did you invent them?
None of them.
Although they're all invented characters.
Every character in the novel is invented, except for David Hossack. Uh-huh. And this comes as a surprise to some people. I'm not sure why. But... I suppose you judge a book by its cover, and it has the suggestion of, it has the aura of historical exactitude, but it's really an historically plausible recreation. And what I've done is I've erected an historical figure, David Hossack, at the center, and surrounded him with a kind of Dickensian cast of fictional characters, some of whom are loosely based on historical figures. Mm-hmm. There's one character we haven't mentioned is an actor. Who comes from England, sort of larger than life Shakespearean actor, and one of the interests in the novel is the theatre in New York at the time, and the theatre played much more of a role in early New York than it does now. It's not just revivals on Broadway; it was in fact a scene of political conflict and playing out political issues. And this at one point in the novel, this English actor is imported. To play various Shakespearean roles and to help in the rivalry between the two major theatre owners in New York. And he makes disparaging comments about Americans at a party. This gets reported in the press by Eamon Casey. And there's a riot at the theatre. And just to give you an example of how the lines between history and fiction can be blurred, the various things that are done by this actor, whose name is Ledbetter, can be historically sourced to a couple of English actors who came out in the early 19th century, one called Frederick Cook and one called Eamon Caine. And Frederick Cook did, in fact, make very disparaging comments about Yankees on board ship, which by the time he'd arrived in New York had been reported in the press, and, yeah, he wasn't allowed to perform. He had vegetables and fruit and chairs, and his hair was set on fire. And he wasn't allowed to perform. And the other way I treat the Ledbetter scandal in the book is him making public apologies in the press. And I suppose the equivalent would be something of Russell Crowe going on David Letterman to apologize for throwing a phone at a hotel employee in New York or something, but a kind of mea culpa from the celebrity, and him having to... I enjoyed very much recreating the prose of the newspapers in the early 19th century. So Ledbetter has to commit himself to print and apologize to the people of New York he was drunk and didn't know what he was doing. And this was, in fact, what Edmund Kean had to do, the famous English actor, when he came out, actually to Boston and not to New York. And what he needed to apologize was for an unorthodox living arrangements with a woman who wasn't his wife. He needed to, in order to be able to perform... The New Yorkers didn't care so much about that, but once he got up to Boston, Puritan Boston, he needed to apologize for that in print in order to be able to perform. So the reason I go into such length about that is to just give you an idea of these. It's not cut and dried what is historical and what is fictional. I read a great number of historical sources, primary sources, and usually the characters that emerge are composites of various people alloyed with pure make-believe, with pure fictional sort of imaginative creation of the character.
Yeah. Well, now I guess I could still ask this question in regards to David Hossack, and because you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that you here we have a real character and the number of things that we know about him that are in the novel, and yet you took some liberties and put him in a situation that perhaps his descendants wouldn't think would put him in very good light. I guess the question I was thinking about was, you know, as an historical novelist, how much do you feel that you can play with the character and create situations for him that clearly did not come from his life? You know, how much do you feel that you owe some fidelity to the historical truth, and to what extent do you feel that you can do whatever you want with that character?
Yeah. Well, talking about the novel more broadly than simply the issue of character, I mean, to what extent did I feel myself constrained by the historical record? Well, I think historical novelists set themselves fairly arbitrary limits, which they renegotiated all the time. But what I set for myself was that in recreating 1820s New York, that I allowed myself, if the novel is loosely set in 1824, but to restrict myself to only 1824 was to restrict myself to too few sort of historical sources. So what I allowed myself, and this is just the bargain I came to in my own mind, not out of any textbook, but was that anything from the 1820s was fair game. Like if there was a particular women's fashion for women's headwear, or if there was a particular store on Broadway, or a particular the building works, or the digging of a canal, or such that happened later in the 1820s. I allowed myself anything from the 1820s. So with only one or two exceptions in the entire novel, I think all the texture of the book and of New York at the time is consistent and strictly accurate to the 1820s. To have been too anachronistic would have really sort of injured the enjoyment for me of going back and recreating the time. Because I really did want to recreate the environment in which they thought, move, and spoke, and dreamed. And I wanted to have the texture of their world right. Just 1824 was too little, but I could do the 1820s. And as for actual historical characters and the liberties I felt I might take, well, as I say, I'm a little apprehensive about what I've done with Hossack. I think the freedom I had with Hossack was precisely the fact that he is so little known now, and that I was not going to have a legion of Hossack scholars emailing me saying, "Oh, you know,
you got this wrong.
He never wore a buff waistcoat. He was 6'1", not 6'. I was not going to have that problem. At one point in the in the drafting process, Washington Irving, a much better known figure, played a big role in the book. I had old chapters devoted to Washington Irving. He now has one line. He doesn't speak, and he's sort of referenced at a dinner party. He shows up, and he's referred to as being somewhat boring in his endless discussions of New York history, which is just a little joke. But at one time, I had long chapters about Washington Irving, and I threw it out for reasons of plot mostly, but also because he didn't come back to New York until 1829, and so a lot of the dates were wrong, and I was really I didn't know much about his character, and I was really recreating him from whole cloth. And at a certain point, I realized this isn't Washington Irving anymore. I'm not actually making any kind of attempt to square my Washington Irving with the Washington Irving of historical record. Maybe this has lost its point at this, you know, now. Maybe I should just cut him loose. And so I did. I just cut him loose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else here who's listening up in Chicago. This is our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
This was roughly the time of Dickens and his writing of London. Is there any relationship with Dickens as far as your writing is concerned? And one more thing I want to get into, and that is that this period that this is the 200th anniversary of the Fulton, Robert Fulton and his steamboat, and also the railroads were just getting started in the United States. I think 1832 was about the date of the
That's right.
the establishment of the Baltimore and Ohio.
Right.
Is there any of that in that?
Oh yeah, that's all very very interesting material. Well, when reading an historical novel, what you don't realize is how much has been left out. And there must be 500, 600, 800 pages left out that just never make it. And a lot of it has this kind of history buff type information. I read a lot about Fulton. Does Fulton appear in the book? Then no. And by the time this novel, the 1820s, there's a mix of sailboats and steamships. It's mostly sail in the harbour, but steamboats are beginning to come into their own. Now, the other things you mentioned about the railway, I think one of the really good things about the book, or it, to the extent that it revives a certain crucial moment in American history, is that it just predates the large-scale industrialization and the opening up of the Western frontier that came with the railway in 1832. And the great irony, the great public's work project that you didn't mention was the Erie Canal, which was opened in 1825, which really did seal New York as the great up-and-coming American city. Because apart from being an engineering project of almost unimaginable scale for the time, it vaulted New York to the commercial forefront. Why? Because in going all the way from New York up through all the way up to Buffalo and to the lakes, it opened up the interior to New York trade, and so overnight New York became the most important trading port. But already by the 1830s, they were laying down the railroads, which made the Erie Canal, if not redundant, then subordinate or secondary. And so looking back, one's naive view looking back might be to think, well, what a waste of time and money the Erie Canal was. But in fact, it's crucial to New York history because it gave New York that decade or more of preeminence on the eastern seaboard that it would not otherwise have had. And who knows how different American history might have been if there'd been no Erie Canal and Boston and Philadelphia had continued to be the most important cities in America into the 1840s. And if New York had only begun to start catching up then in the 1840s rather than in the 1820s. To answer the first part of your question last about Dickens, well, the relationship between my book and Dickens is one of significant inferiority, of course, because Dickens is the great master. And the book that, as I said earlier, began more as of a kind of Jane Austen kind of book. There are two female characters in the book, Virginia and Vera, who are really versions of Eleanor and Marianne Dashwood in Sense and Sensibility. I was teaching Sense and Sensibility at the time and really, really wanted to recreate a kind of Austen-style romance and narrative in the book. And then as I became more and more interested in the politics, I began extending the scope of the book into more Dickensian territory. It really becomes more like a social panorama. I wanted to not recreate both high society and low society, both the upscale west side of Manhattan and the Bowery boys of the east side. I really wanted to recreate the whole city and to show all the different classes of the city. And also, if there's anything else that's been borrowed from Dickens, it's his particular fascination with cities or moments in history where cities are in flux. There's a great deal of change. There's a great deal of mobility. Almost everyone in the novel is either on their way up or on their way down. And New York is a great theatre for that kind of movement. And also physically, geographically in the city, things are moving. All the merchants, having made their fortunes on the docks, are moving away from the old fashionable neighbourhoods of Bowling Green to the south and the south of Manhattan, and moving upwards and building their grand mansions out about, you know, 14th Street and 15th Street, which of course is now to us downtown, but was to then was out in the fields. So there's geographical movement or displacement from south to north. And then there's the age-old social divisions of New York, which are west and east. The west side of New York is the upscale, fashionable City Hall, Columbia College, St. John's Chapel, the wealthier side of Manhattan. And then the east side is the Bowery, the Irish immigrants, the tanning factories, the breweries. And it's in the 1820s, to go back to a point I made right at the beginning of the show, it's in the 1820s that the political power of the middle, lower middle working classes starts to emerge in New York. The rise of the Jacksonian Democrats, the Voting Rights Act enfranchising the people on the east side. And so all political bets are off. Basically in the 1820s, which is why a character like Eamon Casey in the book, who's the Irish immigrant who turned newspaper man, can actually aspire to the governorship, which of course to an old elitist or elite New Yorker like David Hossack is an abomination.
Thank you.
Well, thanks very much for your question.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Gillen Wood. He teaches English here at University of Illinois. His first novel, Hossack's Folly, a novel of old New York, is out now. And if you'd like to read it, you can head out to the bookstore, published by the Other Press, set in the 1820s in Manhattan. I think today that one of the things that maybe either alternately delights or frustrates people when they read Jane Austen is the sense in which the characters are so hemmed in by the social conventions of their time, women particularly, mm-hmm. you know, that there's certain things that you just can't do because it just, you know, wasn't done. It is, I think, a part of our national myth that stuff like that doesn't apply in the United States.
Uh-huh.
But of course, that's not true at all. I mean, we like to talk as if there's no such thing as class in this country. Well, there certainly is, and it probably operates, it would have operated just as much in 1820s New York as it would have been in 1820s London.
Yeah, perhaps, I mean, you've just given me an idea that perhaps something that I can bring to this subject of New York or bring to the subject of America being an Australian is someone with an acute consciousness of class distinctions and also of colonial relationships. And it's something that one growing up in Australia, one is very aware of, made very aware of. And that in 1820s New York, the relationship with Great Britain is that much more real and material than it is today. And so I suppose the novel is perhaps more of a novel about class and about anxieties of nationalism than perhaps an American in my situation might have written. That's purely speculative. But to go back to the first part of what you were saying about characters who are hemmed in by class or by gender, I'd like to talk a little bit about Virginia Casey, who's the daughter of the newspaper man Eamon Casey. And in many ways, I see the entire novel through her eyes rather than any of the male, the more obvious male heroes of the book, in that she is a very talented, intelligent young woman who is luckily born into a wealthy family. Her father, although an Irish immigrant, has made his fortune. So she's well born, but well looked after. But she has absolutely no career prospects. And her situation because there's no career for a young woman at that time. There's no such thing as a profession for her. And so what the Sense and Sensibility sort of love story, where Virginia, of course, is in love in vain with Hossack's young assistant, Albert Dash. And her frustration in love, for me, was more than just simply a typical romantic plot. It was symptomatic of her larger frustrations, her greater social predicament as a gifted young woman who has no prospects before her aside from marriage and domesticity. And she's actually quite the intellectual. She's Albert, who is her beloved, is a botanical draftsman, a trainee doctor, and she manages to convince him to teach her botany. And actually, one of my favourite scenes in the book is early on, a botany lesson where Albert is teaching her botany, and of course she's quite flustered because she's interested in botany, but she's also interested in Albert and trying to find ways to communicate this to Albert, and it produces a lot of comedy. But I think one of the lines from the book says, you know, it was a world of make-believe that she entered into on those afternoons of the botany lessons with Albert. It was a world in which she and Albert were lovers and in which she might actually become a botanist, which, of course, is not the real world for her. I had pity on her in the end, and at the very end of the novel, the door does open a crack for Virginia and her future. And I won't give it away. I won't say what that is. Mm. But Virginia's trajectory is as interesting as any of the other characters in the book. And there's a suggestion that she comes into her own at the end. There is a future for women, for talented young women of her type in the new America.
We're coming down here. We have a couple of minutes left. People will forgive me making an observation. I'm sure I have before in talking with historical novelists, is that historical novels are about two things. They're about the time in which they are set. They are also about the time in which they are written. In what way would you say that Hozak's Folly is not just about New York in 1824, that it's about either New York or the United States in the late 90s or the early 2000s?
Yeah. It opens a window onto a current political predicaments of various kinds. As I sort of adverted to earlier, I think, you know, there are key political, intransigent political issues that we face at the moment in the relation between electoral politics and public health and long-term public health and commercialism. And the great intractable problem that we face now is environmental and global warming in particular. And this study of 1820s New York is almost like a test case for how commercialism, democratic electoral politics, and public health issues can come to an absolute impasse. I fantasize a resolution. I mean, this book ends with, try not to give too much away, this book ends fairly well in terms of a resolution of that problem of aligning democratic political interests with long-term public health. But I feel as if it's a problem that we face now. We certainly haven't provided a solution in this country to the long-term public health issues that we face, which of course are of much grander scope now. They're of a global scope today, whereas in the 1820s, Hozak was facing only, I say only in quotation marks, only the viability of New York City. Now we face the viability of the whole planet. And also, the other key interest in the book is that speaks to our own time is the issue of the media and journalism and its role. That Eamon Casey is a scandalmonger, and he intrudes into the political arena, and he brings people down. He changes changes the political landscape of New York through a particular brand of vulgar journalism. And I think I don't really need to speak at length about that. It's obviously an issue of our time, is that what's the relationship between the media and privacy, and between, particularly, the privacy of political figures. And the summer that I spent in the archives reading about David Hozak was the summer of Clinton's impeachment, and I really began to think about the fate of Hozak in the novel as a kind of a Clintonian fate, someone who's brought down by scandal, and a man with faults and foibles. But the question that the novel asks is, what's the cost-benefit analysis? Do you bring someone down who would otherwise have achieved good things? And, you know, what is a sufficient cause for bringing down such a figure? So I suppose those are some of the political questions that I'm asking, and I hope people who, when they read the book, don't see it as a kind of hothouse flower of American history, mm-hmm. but as something that shows the political, governmental, and social structures of this country in some sort of embryonic form.
Yeah. Well, and certainly it is fun and satisfying because of the, in at least in part because of the recreation of the period.
Right.
And what's going on at the time. So so all of that is there.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to give the impression that it's like some sort of political essay and some sort of dry textbook.
Right.
Ultimately, it's meant to be fun and entertaining. Like Lukács said, you know, the role of the historical novel is not to just retell historical events, but to poetically awaken the characters who made those events happen. And that's really the goal of the novel, to create interesting characters and to tell a great story.
Well, I think you did. I appreciate you being here to talk with us.
Well, thanks, David.
Our guest, Gillan Darcy Wood. He teaches here at the University of Illinois in the Department of English. And the book, Hozak's Folly, a novel of old New York, is his first novel. It's published by The Other Press.